This is the second of two interviews with Laura Seiler. The interview took place on June 19, 1974, in her suite at the retirement community in which she lives. The purpose of the interview was primarily to get some background material, clarify chronology, and later to make sure that a biographical sketch could be written. She was quite reluctant to discuss some aspects, or at least to have recorded some aspects of her personal background, particularly as relating to her father, from whom her mother separated when she was only 8 months old, and also relating to her first husband. It is very likely, in fact, that she will edit out some of the material that was recorded. She requested or commented off tape that she did not want to deal at all with her first marriage. Unfortunately, there were several occasions during which she requested that the tape be turned off. One of these was an especially important piece of material to have been included and related to the details of her confrontation with Harriet Stanton Blatch. There are bits and pieces of the story in quite general and vague terms that were recorded. However, the details, which included her protestation to her sister about the way in which Harriet Stanton Blatch summarily dismissed a secretary, was off tape. She seems reluctant to give too much personal information, including reactions to others, on tape. Some of this, she mentioned later, was derived from her own experience in the advertising world and knowing how things are distorted and used by media.
Enormous parades. One year, I don't remember when it was, must have been when I came down to college to march in it, I think there were over 100 men who marched, and believe me, they had courage. Whew! The only one I happen to remember that I knew was Widder Binner, but there were lots of really quite outstanding men who marched in those parades.
I have a photograph of a man waving from a car, and I think it was that 1912 parade. And there's a banner on the car saying men's...
That would have been the one that I came down to march in, the year before I graduated from college.
Yeah. I think Floyd Dell is the one who was...
Floyd Dell. Yes, I remember him now. Oh, they were really, it took so much more courage for a man to come out from woman's suffrage than it did for a woman. They were quite remarkable. I'm a little surprised. There seemed to me, about the women's lib, it seems to me sometimes that there aren't any men who come out for it much.
Well, I think there are an increasing number of men, and then now the National Organization for Women includes men in its membership, and I think that's actually increasing.
Well, that may well be. I don't touch enough about it. But I do have the feeling, I mostly hear men commenting half amusedly and half not on the fact that women want to go down in the coal mines and join the police department and the other things. They just seem to them perfectly incredible. And of course I point out to them there never will be very many women who want to do those things. But if they do, of course they're the ones that get publicity.
Well, and you know, what I always find remarkable, what I'd like to start with, actually, is getting a little bit more information on your family background. You talked about it being an old New England family traced back to the Revolution, but I didn't, and I know you mentioned that your father and mother separated when you were only eight.
Yeah.
But I had no sense of...
No, when I was a baby, 6 months. I never really met him until I was eight.
Oh, I see.
I don't think I'd exactly like you to put that in.
Oh, okay. Now, you lived in your maternal grandfather's household then?
Yes, I grew up in his household.
In Cornell?
In Ithaca.
In Ithaca.
Yeah.
And what was the house like? Who lived in the house with you?
Well, it was a very large house. That was the day, of course, when you still had sleep-in servants. My grandfather had been a judge. He was always called Judge Ellsworth. I don't think anything very important in the way of a judge. He was a practicing lawyer. Of course, he was very old when we went to live with him. And the house had a large basement, one of these halfway ones, and down in the basement with the half windows was the dining room, an enormous pantry, a huge kitchen, and what was always called the maid's sitting room, because it was furnished so that they could receive, have fun there, you know. And then there was an enormous cellar beyond that. And there was an outside entrance to the maid's sitting room so that their guests could come and go and so forth. And that's where deliveries were made, of course, too. Then there was the next floor had a big central hall, a music room, a library, a front and back parlor, a large, very large bed sitting room and bath that was my grandfather's and grandmother's, and on the other side another bedroom with a room off it, which was as big as the bedroom, but was used for storage. And then up on the next floor, there were one, two, three bedrooms in the front of the house, and that's what was called the sewing room. And then you went down a little flight of steps through a door, and there were one or two rooms for servants. I've forgotten whether there were one or two, and a big storage room, out of which came the most peculiar things when we had to break up the house, among others a straw frame for hoop skates. I don't think anything had been taken out of the room for 25 or 35 years. And there were three children, my sister, who's 7 years older than I, and my brother, who's 5 years older, and me. My grandfather was a Democrat, and a Democrat in upstate New York was an oddity. And he didn't think much of the local papers, so he always had the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle sent to him. And it was a family custom to gather around the table in grandfather's bedroom, and grandfather read the things that he considered important that day. Now, my older sister and brother sat in on those. I was too little. I didn't. I knew about them, but I didn't ever participate. And I may mention, however, that it seems strange as I think of it, because I don't remember any specific conversations. My grandfather was what used to be called a free thinker. He got his Phi Beta Kappa key back in 1835 when he was in Union Law School. And in those days, Phi Beta Kappa was thought to be and was intended to be an organization of free thinkers. After all, what Phi Beta Kappa means, philosophy, the key of life. And he never would go to church. We were Episcopalians. And I can still remember my grandmother asking him to go, and he retorting with a grin, "No, I'm glad to pay for the pew, but you go and sit in it."
So they didn't quite share those attitudes then?
No, he didn't go to church. Well, no, the rest of the family was very orthodox, I should say. But I do remember, and I think it must have been somehow bred into me as a background, though I can't remember any long lectures on these ethical subjects. I think they were just part of the family background. It seems to me that it was very young in my life that I realized that you didn't judge people by what they had, but by what they were, which has always seemed very, very important to me. And I have an idea that many of these things were, as it were, offshoots of my grandfather's conversation and other things that went on in the house.
And now, he was retired at the time that the family moved into the house.
No, he was still a practicing lawyer. He retired when he was, I guess he must have been 81 or 82. He died when he was 84. And the last year or so, we had an old Civil War veteran who acted as companion to him, helped him around.
How old was he when he moved in?
Well, let me just subtract. He was about 74.
Mm-hmm.
No, he was still practicing.
And it was your mother and your three children and your grandmother and grandfather.
And a maiden aunt.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was your grandmother like? Was she a very protected Victorian woman?
Very, I would say. But one of my earliest and most charming recollections is once when I was quite small. Theoretically, the door to my grandfather's bed sitting room was always closed and you locked, you knocked before you went in. But being small, I disregarded that and flung the door open and discovered my grandmother sitting on my grandfather's lap. And I was so surprised. I've never seen anything like that before in my life.
So they never showed any sign of affection in front of the...
Not that I remember, certainly nothing like that. But I remember that very well. And I also remember that they celebrated their golden wedding anniversary. And my eldest aunt came back from St. Louis, where she lived. And that was very exciting. That was in 1899... And my grandmother died very soon after that of pneumonia.
Mm. Oh, so she died when you were still quite young then?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Oh.
She died when I was about 8. And my grandfather died when I was 10.
Now, what was your grandmother's life like? Was it very protected, or did she go out to club meetings?
Oh, I don't remember anything like a club. They went out to receptions, as they were called in those days. And I also remember that they had perpetually going in the winter what was called duplicate whist. You know what that is? It's
mm-hmm.
very entertaining. They had boards just big enough to hold four hands under elastics. And they had a series of them. I don't know exactly how many. I would guess probably 20. This went on all winter. As I recall, they had two tables always in the front parlor. And they played them all the way through as they were on the boards. And they kept track of their scores all the way through. Then they were shifted one to the right, so that they played them through again, playing the hands their opponents had played, and then compared the scores at the end. That was called duplicate bridge, and they did it, duplicate whist, and they did it all winter long. Hmm. No, she was quite an attractive woman, rather small, and I think she led a quite normal social life. My grandfather didn't like very well having people ask to meals. I do remember that. It had to be arranged with him beforehand, and there were not many people that he liked him to have invited for meals. And also, when people came to the house, they normally were calling on my grandmother and aunt and mother. They were entertained up the front, and only very occasionally were they taken back to my grandfather's room.
So he was somewhat of the removed patriarch, in a sense.
Somewhat, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was your mother's life like?
Well, she was mostly concerned, of course, with us. She was very ill in the beginning when we came home. I of course, was only 6 months old, and I am just saying what I was told. I think for a while they weren't at all sure she was going to recover. But then she grew stronger, and she had friends. Of course, she had grown up in Ithaca, so she had plenty of friends when she came back. And she didn't do anything special that I can recall in the way of church work. It's possible that she didn't. I didn't know it. We all went to church very regularly. One of my happiest recollections is during Lent, I always went across the park where our church was with my mother for the 5 o'clock Lenten services, which I enjoyed very much.
But you don't recall her being active outside the house then?
No, I really don't. Incidentally, my mother, of course, being very maternal, I think was sympathetic about suffrage, but I would never say that she was a confirmed suffragist. I don't think it would ever have occurred to her if her daughters hadn't been so much interested.
Now, your grandfather, of course, died before...
He died in 1901.
Mm-hmm. So he had no sense of how he felt about it. Mm.
And I think what got us interested was that Mrs. Blatch's daughter, Nora Stanton Blatch was her name, yes, was a student at Cornell and a great friend of my sister's. And I can remember Nora's coming to dinner and much discussion of suffrage and so forth and so on. So it was no surprise when my sister graduated that she should take a very active part in suffrage in New York.
Now, at this point, though, your grandmother and grandfather had both died.
Oh, yes.
So
mm-hmm.
there was no question of what their attitudes would have been.
That's right. No, I have no idea.
Now, when you mentioned that your family traced back to pre-revolutionary times, that mm-hmm. was on your mother's side then?
Both of them.
Both of them. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And now, were your mother and father separated or divorced?
They were originally just separated. My mother didn't get the divorce until... I think it was in 1900, and my grandfather insisted that she get it because he felt he wasn't going to live much longer and wanted that all settled.
So
I suspect for matters of the estate.
Financial reasons. Because that was one of the things I wondered was that it was very unusual in those early days.
Yeah,
the attitudes toward...
Yes, and my mother, I think, was definitely made to feel it when she returned to the bosom of an Orthodox Episcopal family that just living away from your husband was not the thing to do. And I definitely suffered very much from that when I was a small child because my sister told me very early that I must not ask my mother any questions about it. So that I really hadn't the remotest idea where my father was or what was the matter with him.
Hmm.
And it bothered me a great deal as a child. And other children, some of them had fathers who worked in Buffalo or someplace like that and came home on the weekends, but they came home. I was the only one who had no father. And of course I have since thought that in spite of its enormous disadvantages, which I recognize, that it also probably was partly responsible for my somewhat more friendly and less critical attitude toward men. Because I really never, of course, in my family, encountered the thing known as a dominating male. I mean, my grandfather was then too old and too mellow and, of course, charming with us children. And he never was, I think, the tyrannical sort.
Yeah.
So I just grew up liking men. I never have seen any cause to change my mind.
Do you recall suffering any ostracism or isolation from other children in school because of your mother's divorce, or that wasn't that extreme?
No, nothing like that. I remember that I was always introduced anywhere. I remember the milkman whose beautiful dairy farm I was sent to spend my summers after I'd had a very bad bad attack of flu, I suppose it was. They called it grip. I remember that when he introduced me, people, he always introduced me as Judge Ellsworth's granddaughter. I was very pleased. Grandfather was easily the most important person in my group. I used to spend a great many hours with him after he was retired. And mostly sat about in a chair on the porch or in the house and so forth. So I spent lots of time with him.
Now, you had no contact at all with your father or his family then until you were...
I think I was 8 the first time that we were invited over to Buffalo by my grandmother to spend Christmas. That was, I think, was the first time I ever saw my father. And then we also went back the year they had the World's Fair in Chicago. We spent almost the whole summer in Buffalo going to the fair every other day and staying with my grandmother and my father. But that was about all.
So it was very minimal contact.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the household, what were there any differences in the expectations for you and your sister as compared to your brother in terms of education or what you were...
No, it was always taken for granted. My father had been a Cornell man, and it was always taken for granted that we would all go to college.
The girls, too?
Oh, yes.
Now, had your mother been educated as well?
Mother had wanted to be a doctor, as it turned out. But they told her that she didn't have the physique for it. I think many girls were discouraged in that age by telling them it was too strenuous, they could never do it. So she didn't go to college and was always quite resentful, I think, that she hadn't. I don't think there was a finishing school in Ithaca in her days. I don't recall that she did anything in the way of a special school after she finished high school.
So the granddaughters were the first generation of women actually to be educated?
Yes, to go on to college. Mm-hmm. As far as I know.
So it was primarily just assumed that you would all go on to school?
Oh, yes. It was all, we were infested with the Cornell idea. Students frequently came, of course, to call on my sister. Mm. Oh, no. It was just taken for granted that we would all go to Cornell.
And was it assumed that you would have careers, or was it that education was...
I think it was always assumed that my sister would, because she was utterly devoted to my grandfather and at that time wanted herself to be a lawyer. That was the idea. And she abandoned it only after she took a year off between her junior and senior years in college. She came down and worked for a year in New York. And then it was that she fell in love with Wall Street and decided that she preferred to go into the bond and stock business rather than to be a lawyer.
But so there was encouragement in the family for the idea of her possibly practicing law?
Oh, yes. There was never anything said against it. I mean, she must, I think, have discussed it quite often with grandfather. And, of course, she was determined to do well in school. She got Phi Beta Kappa too and has always had my grandfather's key. I was so cross that there was only one large key that when I got mine, I bought the smallest one there was. It's about an inch long. I was so furious I couldn't have my grandfather's.
Mm. Now, Nora Blackson first came into your house when you were how old was that then? In high school, so wasn't it?
Well, let me think now. That's when we were still... What's this one? My sister graduated in 1908, but she could have graduated in 1907. She took the year off because she wanted to make up her mind what she wanted really to do, because she wound up graduating in the same class with my brother, and actually she was ahead of him. So Nora must have been in and out of our house in 1993 or 1994, I would think. Somewhere in there.
So you were at 19?
I don't think it was during my sister's last year that they so often came. Well, that's hard for me to say. I'm not sure. I only remember that they were in college at the same time and saw a good deal of each other.
What was the response of your mother and your aunt to her and the ideas that she was bringing in? Do you recall?
I don't remember, and I doubt very much that they were talked of before then. Probably not.
Do you recall your first reactions to her and some of those ideas? You were awfully young at the time.
Well, I can only tell you something that I always thought was quite funny. In high school, the speech teacher, or was she just an English teacher? Well, at any rate, she decided it would be highly instructive to have a debate on woman suffrage, and she picked out two boys to carry the affirmative and two girls, of which I was one, to do for the affirmative, the girl and I, and the boys to uphold the negative. And we had a spirited debate before the school assembly. And the really funny thing was that in the heat of rebuttal, I announced in firm tones, the more responsibility you give women, the more they'll have. And there was burst of howls from the audience, and I couldn't imagine from what a moment I had said that was so funny. Oh, I heard about that for years afterwards. Well, we won the debate, but then I was not specially interested in suffrage. I don't ever remember being interested again in it until I was in college. And one day, the boy that I was engaged to, somebody had said something about, does Laura believe, something about suffrage. And I heard him saying, rather smugly, Laura doesn't believe in suffrage or any of that nonsense. And all of a sudden, I knew I did. So that must have been around my senior year, and I forthwith started the suffrage club at Cornell among the co-eds.
I see. So there was a contact which probably led to some germination of ideas that didn't really come to fruition.
No, I wasn't doing anything about it. My sister was already working furiously for it in New York, but I wasn't doing anything about it except reading some of the books and so forth.
Now, you graduated from high school in 1907,
And Cornell didn't take girls till they were 17, so I had to wait a year. And I spent the winter of that year down in Panama. My father was the official estimator he's an architect, on buildings for the canal zone, I believe, when they were building the canal. And my grandmother had been down there with him, and he thought it would be very nice if I came down and spent the winter with my grandmother and him, so I did that. I was there from about October to February or something like that.
You didn't do anything special down there?
No, just had a lot of fun. And I got back just in time to take the last semester in school again. I took some postgraduate work, and then the following autumn, I went to the university.
Now, when you entered Cornell, did you have any idea about the course of study you wanted to take or what you were going to do in the future?
Well, I wouldn't say that I had any very clear idea, because years afterwards, when I was invited back to Cornell to make a vocational speech to the girls, the dean of women said to me, laughing, Laura, do you know what you put on your application when you came in? As a freshman, you were asked what you intended to do. I said, I had no remotest idea. Well, she said, you put down that you intended to be a teacher. And the next question was, why? And you said, because they had such long summer vacations. So that shows you just how much I had in mind about an idea. No, I took what my faculty advisor, who was the head of the Romance Language Department, I was majoring in modern languages, supposedly. I took the minimum number of courses in modern languages to get by for my major, and every year when I took my list of courses up to be okayed by my faculty advisor, he would heave a large sigh and say, well, I suppose since you don't intend to teach, it doesn't matter, but of course this is a salad course. So I just took the courses that interested me, and I took evolution and comparative religions and lots of philosophy, some psychology, all kinds of things. And as I say, a minimum of my major.
Now, was your expectation of having a career, though, at that time?
Or? Oh, yes. I expected to do something, but I had no idea what. Oh, no, my sister would never have let me get to that point with the definite idea that I was going to have a career.
Well, that was one of my questions, in fact, was if you... Did you see combining a career and marriage then when you were, say, student at Cornell and before you had actually married?
Well, I guess I must have, because I definitely was engaged when I left Cornell, and I also was definitely planning to do something. You see, when my grandfather's estate was settled, he had four daughters. And the estate was divided evenly among them, except that he subtracted from my mother's part the very considerable sums of money that he had advanced to her during her most unsatisfactory marriage, so that my mother, with three children, got very much less than the other three who had no children, which made it quite tough. So by the time we were ready to come down to New York, I don't think there was very much capital left. I always expected that I'd be doing something with it in the way of earning a living. I had no very definite ideas about it.
And your sister was down in New York already working?
Oh, yes, in Wall Street.
On Wall Street. And your brother had gone into what year?
My brother had taken both... marine architecture, and I forget whether it was mechanical. I think it was mechanical engineering is his degree. He got degrees in both of them. And he had wanted very much to do marine architecture, I think. But there was absolutely nothing going on like that when he left college. He went for a little while into the experimental basin, as they call it, in Washington, where they were doing experimental things. And then he went into the revenue cutter. He belonged, what did they call them? They had a special name. He was an officer in the revenue cuts, revenue service, I guess they call it. It's I have no idea whether they come under the Navy or not. I don't think they do. I think they're a separate organization. At any rate, he served a term there as an officer for about 3 years. And then he came out. And I don't know whether he went directly from there to the Atlantic Gulf and Pacific Company, but he did. And he was their head engineer for many years before he died. But I don't remember too much about those years in between. It was very difficult for him. He couldn't do what he wanted to do.
One of the things that I found very interesting about several of the women who were involved in suffrage was the assumption that they would be self-supporting.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I tried to pursue is if this was tied into the ideas about suffrage and women's rights, or if it was just an attitude that you had acquired in growing up in your grandfather's household, and it was just...
Well, I would suspect that the emphasis on that must have come probably from my sister and from suffrage ideas. I don't think there would have been anything about my growing up in grandfather's house. In fact, I would think that the whole attitude of the family at that point would have been that... you married and stayed home and had children, and if you were a maiden aunt like the one, that you would stay always in the home if you didn't marry. I think it was assumed that my Aunt Lil would always live in my grandfather's house. No, I would say that was the pattern of a perfectly orthodox Episcopal family.
So that actually, even though you had felt that, well, part of it was just the economics of it.
Yeah.
By the time you were in school.
Yeah. But part of it, unquestionably, my sister would never have allowed me to think of living without doing some work. In fact, I must truthfully say that I sometimes wonder, in fact, I wrote my sister this a while ago, I think she had a great deal to do, actually, with my persisting and having a career, because it would have been very easy for me to give up after I had a baby. In fact, I remember quite clearly when the baby was about a year and a half old. My sister said to me one day, well, when are you planning to go back to work? And I looked somewhat taken aback. She said, well, it's time, you should. And so the next thing she did was to find us an apartment in New York right across the hall from hers and my mother's. And we moved back. We were in East Orange. We moved back to New York, which, of course, made it very much simpler. Because that was a time when I was very lucky, however. I had a marvelous black from Virginia who was with us for... Well, Emma first came to work for me when I lived in East Orange and told me afterward that I was the only woman that she ever washed in the morning and cleaned all the afternoon. Because I knew nothing whatever about domestic things. I really didn't, and I don't know what I would have done. Mother, as I recall it, paid for me to have Emma once a week.
Mm.
Well, when we moved back to New York, we had another woman who proved to be no good at all, and so I begged Emma, and she consented to come and stayed with us all the time my baby was growing up. Was marvelous.
So your sister was really a very important role model for you from
very,
very early years.
Definitely. Oh, Jess, I, looking back, I realize how great an influence she had. For instance, I doubt that I ever would have taken public speaking in college if it hadn't been for my sister. She won the prize for the Woodford, which is an original oration. And the title of her oration was Men, Women, and Human Beings. Well, I came along and I survived the competitions and was on what they call the stage. In other words, I was one of the eight speakers on both the 86 Memorial and the Woodford oration. But I didn't win either one of them, much to my sister's chagrin. And my title for my original oration was Crimes Against Criminals. I having spent quite a lot of time down the east side with my sister seeing what went on, and also quite a lot of time in the dear me, what did they call that court? It used to be over in the old Jefferson Court building. No, I don't remember now. Oh, the Night Court.
Oh, that was when you were still at Cornell. Then.
No, that was after I came to New York.
No,
it was. It was. It's when I spent the summer with my sister between my junior and senior years.
Oh, because you talked about being a reporter for some paper and going to the Night Court, and I wasn't
yeah,
sure what time
right,
that was. Oh, I see. So when was it that you became engaged then in your school career at Cornell?
When I was a senior, I guess. At least I was already engaged when I graduated.
Mm. And there was no problem in terms of your husband's attitude towards your pursuing your career either?
No, I don't think it ever occurred to him.
Mm.
Now, I'm turning this thing off a minute. Charming man, and a very, very gentle one, and a very open-minded one, very good-natured person. No, I don't think left to himself that it would ever have occurred to him to advocate suffrage, but he was not against my doing it, and he never made any fuss. Of course, I think he probably was rather pleased. He wasn't getting a very big salary in those days, and it was quite helpful to have a second salary. So, also, of course, it was the example of my sister, who just gone ahead and done it and was getting to be quite well known in Wall Street.
Now, was your sister's influence as a result of your admiration for her? Was she also quite direct in letting you know how she felt your life should be lived?
No, she's not. Was not aggressive, if that's what you mean. No, I wouldn't say so. But to her, of course, the arguments are absolutely unanswerable. She just is and always was a feminist. So, I would say that I might or might not. My daughter thinks that I would have climbed the walls if I'd tried to stay home. But I've sometimes wondered if I would have gone back into business if my sister hadn't urged me.
So when you left Cornell then, now at Cornell, aside from this experience with the debate, do you recall any heckling or ridicule on the part of the other students towards the women who were suffragists?
No. Of course, we were not very aggressive suffragettes. We met in the women's dormitory where we had our meetings, except for this debate. I don't recall that we did any other public thing. The others were all just meeting by ourselves.
Now, the group had been going for a while before the debate was... Now, then you graduated in 1913, and you went on this organizing tour accompanied by your mother.
Which lasted until autumn.
Now, was this viewed as just an interim activity?
Oh, yes. It was just suggested that since I was right there, so to speak, and doing nothing, if I give my summer to this, I think I must have been paid something, but I don't remember what. Must have been microscopic. Of course, expenses. And then I was, when I got back to New York, they made me the head of the Speakers Bureau, and I was supposed to coach all the volunteer speakers. We spoke on street corners all the time, every night.
So you were actually training people to do speaking then? And you were still speaking yourself as well? Now, when you graduated and went on the tour, was your expectation that after the tour you would go back to New York and work?
Oh, well, we were going to New York. That's where my sister and brother already were, you see. There was no question where we were going.
Oh, I see.
And then I didn't have any very decided feeling one way or the other. I knew that I was expected to go back to the organization in New York and do something for a while. But then I've forgotten how long I did that. I didn't get on too well as the president. I thought her terribly autocratic, Mrs. Blatch. How long did I stay with the suffrage organization?
Because it sounded like that was one of the impressions I had. It sounded like it was you got that job at Macy's in 1914 sometime, I believe you said. So it would have been almost a year.
Yes, I would say that I didn't do the speaker's job for more than 6 months, perhaps, something like that. Not very long. I didn't approve of the several things that Mrs. Blatch did within the organization. I thought her very arbitrary and didn't like it too well. And
that's one of the areas I wanted to get into, was the way in which that organization was structured and decisions were made and the leadership role.
Well, the president was Mrs. Blatch, and my sister was the vice president. And I